Instead of inviting him in, she came through the door pulling a roll-on bag. What's with the suitcase? DeMarco asked.
I told you, I got four names. We're going to go see them.
And you need a suitcase?
Yeah.
We'll go to your motel first, and you can check out. Wait a minute. Where are these people located?
The first one's in Minot. The next one...
Where's Minot?
In North Dakota,
she said, looking at him like he'd asked where Paris was. It's about 100 miles from Bismarck. The next one's in Great Falls. Then she added,
that's in Montana. It's about 8 hours from Minot.
8 hours? DeMarco said. Then, because he couldn't help it, he said it again. 8 hours?
Yeah. I figured we'd go in a loop. Minot to Great Falls, then Great Falls to Billings, then Billings to Rapid City.
Jesus Christ, he muttered. Can we fly?
We could, but it will be faster to drive. You can't get direct flights to most of these places.
He tried to think of a way to get out of this. Maybe he should tell her that he'd wait for her in Bismarck, and when she learned something, to give him a call. But he didn't. Instead, he followed her down the sidewalk like a man walking to the gallows, and opened the trunk of his rental car so she could toss her suitcase in. 30 minutes later, he checked out of the Holiday Inn and gassed up his car. He wondered where they'd be staying that night. She directed him turn by turn out of Bismarck until they reached US 83. Minot was due north of Bismarck. So who are we seeing in Minot? DeMarco asked.
A retired judge.
And what did he do wrong?
He didn't do anything wrong.
Then why?
This guy, his name is Parker, had a case before him involving forced pooling.
Forced pooling? What's...
Curtis was suing landowners in Ward County for blocking surveys on their land to determine where to drill for gas. The lawsuit said Curtis's company had been negotiating in good faith with the landowners, but the landowners weren't playing ball as required to do by the law.
I still don't understand. What's forced pooling? Sarah gave an exasperated sigh to indicate what she thought of DeMarco's abysmal ignorance.
I'll keep this simple. Gas companies don't drill straight down to get the gas. What they do is get a lease to drill on one parcel of land that has gas under it. Then they basically drill sideways or horizontally to get at the gas in adjacent parcels. The gas under all these parcels combined is called a pool. And you can look this up if you don't believe me, but 39 states in this country have laws that essentially mandate that the owners of these adjacent parcels have to allow the companies to drill under their property if the company can get leases from a certain percentage of the landowners over the pool. That's what they mean by forced pooling.
This was just like Sarah's blog, totally confusing. But he imagined she was right about the law. Sarah continued.
Both Republicans and Democrats in the areas affected are against these forced pooling laws. Some people object for safety and environmental reasons, like they're afraid their well water would become contaminated. Others object on principle, feeling that they're being forced to give up their property rights, which they are. But somehow the gas and oil companies always prevail, no matter how many people object. Anyway, to get back to Judge Parker, like I said, Curtis filed a suit in this one county against a bunch of landowners because they were doing everything they could to block him from drilling. Curtis's suit said they weren't acting in the spirit of the law. Well, Parker stands up in court one day and makes a raving speech about how he can't be bought, but then recuses himself from the case to avoid the appearance of impropriety. It was obvious that Curtis had tried to buy Parker off, but once again, what was obvious to Sarah wasn't a matter of what could be proven. It was just her opinion. But when I asked Parker what happened, he refused to tell me. He was a prick. He said that if he wouldn't discuss his reason for recusing himself with the legitimate media, he sure as hell wasn't going to talk to some wet-behind-the-ears blogger.
What makes you think he'll talk to you now?
Because he's retired, so maybe he'll feel differently. The other thing is, Parker isn't really a bad guy. I researched him a little more after I started to think about who might help me, and he works at a homeless shelter on weekends, volunteers at polling booths, that sort of thing. I called him a prick, but he's more of a curmudgeon. I'm hoping now that he's no longer on the bench, he'll change his mind about talking to me.
They arrived at Parker's home in Minot about 4 p.m. The house was a nice-looking place with a well-tended front yard, but not ostentatious. In other words, the kind of house an honest judge might own. You want me with you while you talk to him? DeMarco asked.
I don't think so. You look kind of intimidating.
I thought that was the reason for me coming with you, to be intimidating.
Intimidation isn't going to work on this guy.
DeMarco watched her walk up the sidewalk to Parker's house, sulking about the intimidating comment. He could act intimidating, but he didn't think he looked intimidating, like he had a face that would scare little kids or something. He had dark hair he combed straight back, a prominent nose, blue eyes, and a cleft in his chin. He'd been told he looked just like his father. And he had to admit that his dad could look intimidating, particularly if he was angry, but he didn't think he looked that way, at least not when he smiled.
DeMarco saw Sarah ring the judge's doorbell, and a moment later a balding guy in his 70s wearing an apron answered the door. Sarah talked to him for no more than a minute before he shut the door. She came back to the car and said, "What a prick."
"Where are we going next?" DeMarco asked.
"I told you, Great Falls. We can drive at least halfway there today. Maybe stay in Glasgow tonight and get up early tomorrow. We can be in Great Falls by mid-morning tomorrow."
"Glasgow, Montana?"
"Yeah. Did you think I meant Scotland?"
Marjorie's cell phone rang just as she was getting ready to leave the office to go to Bobby's baseball game. It was Heckler.
"What's going on?" she said.
"She went to see a guy named Raymond Parker in Minot. He used to be a..."
"Yeah, I know who Parker is. So what happened?"
"As near as I can tell, he slammed the door in her face. She talked to him for about 2 seconds, and that was it."
"Good. Was DeMarco with her?"
"Yeah, but he just sat in the car when she talked to Parker. He's driving her."
"So where is she now?"
There was a long pause.
"Heckler,"
Marjorie repeated.
"Where is she now?"
I ran out of gas."
"You ran out of gas?"
"Yeah. They left Minot and started driving west. I didn't think they'd drive too far, and, I mean, they just kept going and going and going, and gas stations aren't all that close together on US 2, and..."
Marjorie just lost it. "God damn son of a..."
"Jesus, I'm sorry, Marjorie." "So, what in the hell are you going to do?"
"I guess I'll head back to Bismarck and wait for her. By the time I get somebody way out here to gas me up, she'll have a 3-hour lead on me."
"But can't you track her with the GPS in her phone?"
"She's out of range already," Heckler said.
Marjorie wondered if he was lying about the tracking software having some sort of limited range. She suspected that Heckler, the lazy shit, didn't want to drive any farther and try to catch up with Johnson. But she didn't know for sure, and she didn't see any point in continuing to swear at him, but she felt like killing him. She wanted to know who that crazy girl was going to see next. The good news was that if Murdoch did his job right, they wouldn't need Heckler anymore because, in the future, Marjorie would always know where Sarah Johnson was. She'd be in a grave. The problem with taking a long road trip with Sarah was that she only cared about one thing in life: crucifying Leonard Curtis. When she spoke about what Curtis was doing, undermining Mom, apple pie, and the American way, she became animated, waving her arms, talking so fast she sometimes sputtered. But there didn't seem to be much else that interested her. At one point, DeMarco asked, "Have you got a boyfriend?" Then he added, "Or a girlfriend?" She'd been looking at something on her smartphone when he asked the question, and she sighed, as if she didn't appreciate the interruption, and said, "Not anymore. I was going with a guy in Billings for about 6 months. I met him at a Sierra Club rally. Then I found out he wasn't really passionate about anything. I mean, he cared, but he wasn't really committed. When I told him this, he said I was too intense for him."
"No shit," DeMarco thought.
"And we broke up. I don't really have time for a boyfriend right now anyway."
She sounded regretful, however, and DeMarco imagined she must get lonely. He almost said that Joan of Arc didn't have a boyfriend either, but decided it wasn't the time to be a smartass.
"Sarah, I admire what you're trying to do. Honest, I really do. But you're a young woman, and there's more to life than chasing after Leonard Curtis. I mean, at your age and with your money, you ought to be traveling through Europe, snorkeling in Tahiti. It's not healthy to be so obsessed with Curtis."
"Yeah, people are always telling me that. One of my friends said I should see a psychiatrist."
"Well, maybe.
The thing is, nobody else cares about what people like Curtis are doing.
If somebody doesn't try to stop him, that's not true, Sarah. Lots of people care. There are all kinds of folks out there trying to reform campaign financing and reduce the influence of lobbyists. But these people also have lives. They have families. They have hobbies. They have fun.
Don't you understand? Sarah said. There's a crisis in this country. People like Curtis are buying politicians to get their way. Things have to change.
Yeah, I know, but
like judges. Why the hell do we elect state judges? Judges shouldn't be elected. If they're elected, then it's easier for guys like Curtis to corrupt the legal system by contributing to their campaigns and running negative ads against them on television. State judges ought to be like the judges on the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, appointed for life.
DeMarco almost said, U.S. Supreme Court justices are sort of elected, too. When you put a president in office, you're basically electing the kind of guy that the president will appoint to the Supreme Court if he gets the chance. But he knew that would just start her on another rant. Sarah, all I'm saying is that life is short. Enjoy it while you have the chance. She just turned away from him and looked out at a field, a green sea of barley. They stopped at about 8 p.m. in Glasgow, the one in Montana, and checked into a place called the Star Lodge. Sarah offered to pay for his room, but DeMarco said he'd pay for it, not bothering to tell her that if she paid taxes, she was paying for it anyway.
I'm going to find out where to get a martini in Glasgow, DeMarco said. You want to come along?
No, I've got things to do, people to call.
Jesus, Sarah. Have you ever heard that expression about stopping to smell the roses?
And vodka smells like roses, she said.
Chapter 11. Bill Logan arrived at the steam bath in Denver an hour early, hoping the steam would lessen the hangover he had. When he'd arrived in Denver the night before, he had dinner, then just sat in the hotel bar and started pouring scotch down his throat. This thing with Murdoch and Sarah Johnson was turning him into a drunk. It was even affecting his sex life. He was a guy who usually got laid 4 or 5 nights a week. He knew so many women, he could always get laid. But last night, sitting in the bar of the Hilton, there was a woman who looked like she might be a stewardess. She was close to 40, not a beauty queen, but not bad-looking either, and she'd glanced his way a couple of times. Normally, with a woman like her, Bill figured he'd have to buy her 2 drinks, and then it would be off to her room to do the hokey-pokey. But last night, he hadn't been able to work up the energy for romancing her, and he just sat there drinking scotch, imagining what it would be like to be in prison. With his luck, his roommates would be 2 psychopaths who would take turns beating and raping him. Murdoch walked into the steam room at 10, wearing a white towel around his waist. He made a motion for Bill to stand up, and Bill did, knowing what he was supposed to do. He dropped his towel on the bench where he'd been sitting and made a slow turn so Murdoch could see he didn't have anything taped to his back. Then Murdoch did the same thing, after which he looked under the bench to make sure Bill hadn't hidden a recorder there. Murdoch looked exactly as he had the last time Bill saw him 6 years ago. It didn't appear as if he'd aged a bit. Apparently, killing people was good for his constitution. And like the first time Bill met with him, he couldn't help but think the guy just didn't look like a professional killer. He should have had barbed wire tattoos circling his arms, or those teardrop tattoos the gang guys had to show how many people they'd killed. Bill told him what they needed him to do, take care of Sarah Johnson. He said, "It doesn't have to be an accident this time because we're in a hurry. Make it look like a robbery gone bad, or maybe a rape."
"I don't rape people," Murdoch said. And he said this like he was offended.
Apparently, killing people didn't bother him, but he considered rape to be repulsive.
"Sorry," Bill said, not sure what else to say. "All I'm saying is, we don't need something fancy. Just make it look like it's part of some other crime, but not like she was singled out. You know what I mean?"
"Yeah," Murdoch said. Jesus, he couldn't believe what he was doing and saying. His hangover was almost gone, thanks to the steam. But when he left the gym, he was going straight to the airport and start tossing back drinks until the plane landed in Bismarck. They were going to have to carry him off that plane. DeMarco was in a deep, dreamless sleep in his room at the Star Lodge in Glasgow, Montana, when someone began to pound on the door. He looked at the bedside clock, 6 a.m. He got out of bed, dressed in boxer shorts and his favorite Nationals t-shirt, and opened the door. Not surprised, he found Sarah standing there, looking impatient.
"What are you doing, still sleeping?" she said. "We need to get going."
"Sarah, it's six in the fu- It's six. Are you insane?" Before she could say anything, he added, "Go away. I'll see you at 8. Then we'll go have breakfast, or I'll have breakfast. Then we'll take off."
He shut the door, trudged over to the bed, and fell onto it. What a nut. She spent the first hour of the drive to Great Falls sulking, and he was in no mood to cajole her. Finally, he said, "Who are we going to see in Great Falls? Another judge?"
"Do you really care?" she said.
As he was trying to decide how he should answer that question, Sarah said, "I'm going to talk to a lawyer." She represented a group of ranchers suing Curtis for well water contamination caused by fracking. If she'd won, it would have been a huge blow to Curtis. Like this year, 40 plaintiffs sued a natural gas company in New York, and the gas company, after fighting the case for years, finally settled with them for millions, and that's what could have happened to Curtis. Anyway, the lawyer involved was a woman named Janet Tyler. She's really good, and it looked like she might have been able to beat Curtis. Then she backed out of the case, and after she did, the whole case fell apart. I went to see her because it was obvious that Curtis had done something to get to her. I didn't think he'd bribed her because Tyler has money. And when I saw her speak on some local news program, I could tell she had a fire in her belly about the issue. I called her office, and when she wouldn't speak to me, I hung around outside her office until she went out to lunch, and...
Ah, so you stalked her.
You're not funny, DeMarco. Anyway, when I asked her why she dropped the lawsuit, I could tell she felt bad about what she'd done. But she wouldn't tell me what happened. I finally gave up. But as I was leaving, she said, I didn't have a choice. When I asked her what she meant, she got into her car and drove off. After I met with her, I did some more research on her, the kind of research I should have done before I met with her. I found out that she had a son, but she was divorced, and her son used her ex-husband's last name, and she uses her maiden name. Well, her son had been busted by the cops. He was an oxycodone addict, and he broke into an old lady's home to steal shit. He thought the old lady was gone, but she wasn't, and she tried to stop him, and he pushed her down and she smacked her head. But she was a tough old bird. She followed him out of the house after he ran, got his license plate, and called the cops. The cops went to his house to arrest him, and he punched one of the cops. So her kid was charged for breaking and entering, robbery, assaulting an old lady, assaulting the cops, and resisting arrest. They had like a dozen charges against him, and he was going to do time, maybe 4 years. Well, voila. After Tyler drops out of the well water contamination lawsuit, her son's case is pled down to 2 years probation, drug counseling, anger management classes, mandatory community service, blah, blah, blah. Everything but jail time.
Did you find anything resembling evidence that Curtis had anything to do with her son's case?
No. And fuck you for that resembling evidence crack. But the answer is no. I couldn't find any evidence that the judge or the prosecutor in her son's case had suddenly come into money or had some work done for free on their houses. But if you think it's a coincidence that her son got off scot-free at the same time she dropped the suit, then you're a complete idiot.
DeMarco was thinking maybe they should send her to anger management classes, or charm school.
"What makes you think Tyler will talk to you now?" he asked.
"I don't know that she will. But her son's dead. He got high, ran his car into a ditch, and broke his neck. I know she felt guilty about what she did, and since her son's gone, maybe she'll talk."
Sarah again decided to meet with Janet Tyler by herself. DeMarco said,
"I thought the whole point of me coming with you was for me to lean on these people. You know, I say I'm from Washington and I'm here to crush you with the entire weight of the federal government if you don't tell the truth."
"Yeah, but I've been thinking that's not the right approach. Not with these people. The four I picked are all people who I think have a conscience and might feel bad about what they did, so I don't really want to scare them. I just want to convince them to do the right thing. And frankly, you don't exactly look like you're from the government."
"What does that mean? What do I look like?"
"Well, You look like a guy a loan shark might send to break the legs of somebody who owes him money.
You gotta be kidding, DeMarco said.
Sarah spent 20 minutes with Tyler, and when she came back to the car, she said,
I can't believe how bad that woman looks compared to the last time I saw her. She's lost about 30 pounds and looks like she's 70 years old. I know she's in her 50s.
Yeah, but did she tell you anything?
No. She started crying and saying she was sorry about what she'd done and how I didn't understand that she had to do it for her son, but she wouldn't give me a name or tell me how they got to her.
You sure you don't want me to talk to her? DeMarco said.
Yes, it won't do any good.
They spent the night at a Holiday Inn Express in Great Falls. DeMarco was thinking about buying stock in the outfit. The next morning, the day after seeing Janet Tyler in Great Falls, Sarah and DeMarco were on the road again, off to see the next two people on Sarah's list, a man in Billings, Montana, and a woman in Rapid City, South Dakota. Both people had served in their state legislatures but were no longer in office. Only one memorable thing happened on this leg of their journey, or at least it was something DeMarco would remember for a long time to come. They were traveling southeast on Highway 87, along the eastern perimeter of the Lewis and Clark National Forest. DeMarco was driving and enjoying the scenery while Sarah was looking at her iPad. DeMarco figured she was investigating something online related to natural gas or Leonard Curtis when she suddenly let out what he could only describe as a peal of joyful, girlish laughter.
"What's so funny?" he asked.
She laughed again and said, "One of my girlfriends sent me this YouTube clip of this kitten swatting this big dog on the snout. The dog, it's a huge St. Bernard, comes close to this little kitten, and the kitten smacks it on the nose, and the dog blinks a couple of times and backs up. Then he comes close to the kitten again, and the kitten smacks him on the nose again. It's hilarious!"
DeMarco didn't say anything for a moment, then said,
"You need to do that more often."
"What?"
Sarah said.
"Laugh like that," DeMarco said.
But that was the only memorable thing that happened. The man who Sarah had planned to see in Billings wasn't home. They learned from a neighbor that he'd left unexpectedly the night before to go see a brother who'd had a heart attack. The woman in Rapid City refused to talk with Sarah, slamming the door in her face the way Judge Parker and Minot had. By the time they reached the duplex where Sarah lived, she looked like someone had killed her puppy and ate it while she watched.
"I gotta regroup," she told DeMarco as they pulled up in front of her duplex. "I think you had a good idea about running down whoever's acting as Curtis's middleman, and I have to think more about how to find him. And you need to call John Mahoney and convince him to get the FBI involved."
She'd said this, about getting the FBI involved, maybe 60 times, as they'd been making a trip that covered 3 states and almost 1,500 miles. He liked the kid, but she was starting to drive him bonkers, and he was relieved when she got out of the car. Marjorie was sitting in the family room, watching a stupid zombie movie with Dick and the boys. Dick was sulking, as she'd just about ripped his head off when she got home because the kitchen was a disaster. Unwashed dishes, food all over the counter, mustard spilled onto the floor, the milk just sitting there, spoiling. So she had a right to get angry. But she probably shouldn't have called him names. Maybe she'd make it up to him by giving him a blowjob tonight. Something she considered the ultimate sacrifice for marital harmony. She wasn't really watching the movie, either. She was stewing about her partner. Bill Logan was turning into a drunk. The day after he returned from Denver, he went out to lunch and came back to the office 2 hours later completely shit-faced. Maybe after Murdoch dealt with Johnson, he'd get back on track. She sure as hell hoped so, because things couldn't go on the way they were. As for Johnson, she still hadn't gotten back from wherever she'd been, and because Heckler lost her when he ran out of gas, Marjorie still had no idea who she'd gone to see. All Gordy could tell from the spyware planted in her cell phone was that she made what appeared to be overnight stops in Glasgow and Great Falls, Montana. Marjorie needed to... Her phone rang. It was Heckler. Into the phone, she said, "Hang on a minute." To Dick and the boys, she said, "Excuse me, I have to take this." Then she patted Dick on the thigh and said, "I'm sorry I got so mad earlier." But he ignored her and sat there pouting. She walked into the kitchen.
"Yeah, what is it?"
"She's back," Heckler said. "DeMarco just dropped her off at her place."
"Good.
Now I want you to forget about her and get on to Markle. I want to know what he's up to.
Heckler said, shit, then I gotta go. I gotta catch up with him before he's out of sight.
Go, she said, and disconnected the call. She couldn't tell Heckler that the real reason she wanted him following DeMarco was because she couldn't afford to have him hanging around Sarah Johnson when Murdoch made his move. Wouldn't that be the icing on the cake? Heckler stopping Murdoch from killing the brat. Plus, she really did want to know what DeMarco was doing. She figured that after Johnson was gone, he'd most likely go home. But since she didn't really know why he was here in the first place, she couldn't be sure. She called Bill next.
She's back home. Text the guy. You know who I mean.
Bill said, yeah, geez, okay. He sounded like he was drunk. Again.
You better get your act together, Bill, she snapped. This boozing shit can't go on.
Yeah, I know, he said, and hung up. Men. If it wasn't her husband, it was Bill Logan. She went back to the family room. The good guys were mowing down the zombies with machine guns. When she'd left the room to talk to Heckler, they'd been doing the same thing. That seemed to be the entire plot of the movie. But her sons didn't seem to care. Anybody want popcorn? She said, trying to sound perky and cheerful. The boy said, yeah. Dick, he just pouted. Okay, no blowjob for you tonight, asshole. As she waited for the popcorn in the microwave to stop popping, her mind flipped back again to Johnson and DeMarco. What the hell had they been doing the last 3 days? Whatever it was, she sure as hell hoped it didn't come back and bite her on the butt. DeMarco called Mahoney's cell phone to tell him what was going on and was shocked when Mahoney answered. DeMarco was in a bar in Bismarck when he made the call, not expecting Mahoney to answer, and it sounded like Mahoney was in a bar in D.C. when he took the call. DeMarco summarized what was happening as quickly as possible. He had to be quick because Mahoney wasn't known for either patience or a long attention span. He told him that Sarah Johnson was obsessed with nailing a rich guy named Curtis who was bribing politicians and judges, but she had no proof. On the other hand, she'd clearly pissed Curtis off because he was doing whatever he could to stop her.
Is he behind the death threats? Mahoney asked.
I don't know. She names a lot of people in her blog, so Curtis isn't the only suspect. But is he really bribing folks?
Probably. But Sarah can't prove it. I just spent the last 3 days driving all over the American West with her. I was hoping to get a lead on Curtis's fixer, but I struck out. So I don't know what to do next. But I can't spend the rest of my life out here in the sticks following her around.
You think she's in danger?
DeMarco hesitated.
She could be. She's not going to stop investigating Curtis. She's the type who won't ever stop. And I don't know what to do about that either, unless you want me to become her full-time bodyguard.
What am I supposed to tell Doug? Mahoney asked.
Doug?
Her grandfather. My buddy. Have you gone soft in the head?
I guess you tell him you tried, but there really isn't anything you can do. You can't call up the Attorney General and tell him to investigate Curtis just because Sarah thinks Curtis is doing something illegal. Then you tell him his crazy granddaughter needs to hire a bodyguard.
Now it was Mahoney's turn to hesitate.
You go tell him.
Aw, come on, DeMarco said. DeMarco had called Mahoney from a restaurant called the Peacock Alley American Bar and Grill. It was located in a historic building that began as a hotel in 1911, served as a speakeasy during Prohibition, and back in those days hosted illegal gambling and a few women of ill repute. The bar of the restaurant was located in what had once been the lobby of the old hotel. It was a place where the patrons dressed casually, which suited DeMarco, and it had large windows, a red brick-like floor, a long, dark bar with comfortable, high-backed stools, and an impressive number of beers on tap. There was a brass rail separating the drinkers from the diners, and the walls were covered with black-and-white photos of Bismarck in the early 20th century. DeMarco was tired from driving all day and from listening to Sarah nag at him. He was thinking he should go to a laundromat because he was wearing his last pair of clean underwear, but who wanted to spend the evening at a laundromat? If he could get a flight out tomorrow evening, he'd go see Sarah in the morning and tell her he was sorry, but he had to get back to D.C. If she ever found any real evidence, something more than a guy getting a bargain price on a seed drill, to give him a call and he'd try to convince Mahoney to lean on the FBI. He knew if he made that offer, he'd regret it because she'd probably call him twice a day. Anyway, that was the plan. See Sarah in the morning, then go see Doug Thorpe and tell him basically the same thing, that if Sarah ever found any actual evidence that Curtis had done something illegal, Mahoney would help. Until then, his granddaughter needed to hire a bodyguard, some strapping Montana lad with a license to carry a weapon. Insofar as the dirty underwear situation, after he had dinner, he'd go back to the motel and wash out the pair of boxers he was wearing in the motel sink. Or better yet, maybe he'd swing by Walmart and just buy a pair. He ordered a second martini and took out his phone to look at flight schedules. Using one finger, he'd never been a thumb texter, he started to tap in the Travelocity website when a voice said, "You one of those tweeters?" He looked over at the speaker, a blonde in her late 30s. She was pretty, a little plump, but not too plump, and with a pleasant amount of cleavage showing. No, never tweeted in my life. I was just, "So, what are you doing here in Bismarck? Are you a roughneck?"
"A roughneck?"
"You know, a driller. One of the guys who works on the gas wells. You got the build for it."
DeMarco figured that was a compliment.
"I'm a lawyer from D.C.
He added that his boss had sent him out here to help an old friend with a problem, and before she could ask what the problem was, he asked what she did. He found out that she was a math teacher, taught fifth grade, divorced, no kids. Deep into his second martini, he asked, "By the way, what the hell is a seed drill?"
"A seed drill?"
"Yeah, I heard the term a couple of days ago and was just curious."
"Well, city boy, a seed drill is a farm implement used to plant seeds. I mean, scientifically. These days, farmers don't plant by poking a hole in the ground with a stick and dropping a seed in. They use these fancy machines called seed drills that have computers and GPS systems and are calibrated so every possible inch of farmable space is planted."
"I'll be damned," DeMarco said. "You want another drink?"
And at that moment, his phone rang. It was Sarah. She was like a demon who had escaped from hell and couldn't be forced back down to the underworld where she belonged. "Just a sec," he said to the teacher. "Yeah, Sarah, what is it?"
"I think I found something. Come over to my place."
"Sarah, you need to get a life. We just spent the last 3 days together, and no offense, but I need a break from you. I'll stop by and see you first thing in the morning."
Then he disconnected the call before she could argue with him. Then he turned the phone off, the only way to escape a modern demon. "Who's this Sarah person you spent the last 3 days with?" the teacher asked. Heckler could see DeMarco there at the bar, chatting up some blonde. It didn't look like he was planning to leave any time soon, which wasn't good as far as Heckler was concerned. He was tired and needed to get some sleep. He walked up to the bar and made a motion for the bartender to come talk to him. Heckler and the bartender had gone to high school together, and the bartender knew what Heckler did. He asked the bartender who the blonde was, and the bartender told him. He said the woman was practically a fixture at the American Grill. An hour later, DeMarco and the blonde left together. DeMarco followed the blonde to her place, and Heckler followed DeMarco. When DeMarco was still inside the blonde's house an hour later, Heckler called it a night, thinking he was getting way too old for this shit. On the other side of Bismarck, Murdoch sat in a car. He could see the lights were on in both sides of the duplex, meaning Sarah Johnson's landlady was home and awake. He'd wait until they both went to bed.
Chapter 12.
DeMarco woke up feeling groggy, disoriented, and hungover. It took him a minute to figure out where he was. The teacher's bedroom. He turned his head. All he could see was the top of her head, a mass of blonde curls, and one bare, freckled shoulder. He eased out of bed, trying not to wake her, and got dressed. This was the one part of a one-night stand he hated, trying to figure out what to do in the morning before he left. He'd made it clear to the teacher, her name was Amelia, that he'd be leaving to go back to D.C. today. So he hadn't lied to her, and he hadn't pretended that he'd be coming back to Bismarck for a second date. But still, it gave him that greasy lounge lizard feeling to sneak out of her house without even saying goodbye. He went into her bathroom and used her toothpaste and his finger to brush his teeth. Then he hunted around the kitchen until he found paper and a pen. He scratched out a note saying he'd enjoyed last night, and if he ever passed through Bismarck again, he'd give her a call. He had no intention of ever passing through Bismarck again. He glanced at his watch as he started the car. 7 a.m. Knowing Sarah, she'd probably been up since dawn, ranting on her blog, but it still seemed a bit early to be knocking on her door. He stopped for coffee and an Egg McMuffin at the first McDonald's he saw, then proceeded on to his motel, where he packed his clothes. He tossed his suitcase full of smelly clothes into the trunk of his rental car, he'd put a lot of miles in that car, and headed toward Sarah's place. She'd told him last night that she'd found something, but he'd interrupted her before she had a chance to say exactly what she'd found. Maybe she'd identified whoever was helping Curtis corrupt local politicians, but knowing the way Sarah tended to draw conclusions not necessarily supported by facts, he wasn't hopeful. Marjorie had been in the office for more than an hour when Heckler called. DeMarco spent the night with a woman named Amelia Moore. He picked her up at the American Grill. Moore's a teacher. I know who she is, Marjorie said. Moore was Bobby's math teacher, the same gal that Bill had been screwing. Jesus, what a slut. DeMarco went back to his motel about 7:30 this morning. 10 minutes later, he came out and tossed a suitcase into the trunk of his rental car. It looks like he may be leaving town. Well, follow him to be sure, Marjorie said. It would be a relief to have DeMarco gone, although she still wished she knew what he'd been doing with Sarah Johnson after he left Minot the other day. It was after 8 by the time DeMarco arrived at the duplex where Sarah lived. He knocked, but no one answered. Then he noticed the door, the area where the lock goes into the frame. The wood had been splintered, like someone had taken a crowbar or a big screwdriver and ripped open the door. He thought to himself, oh shit, and pushed on the door with the tip of one finger, and it swung open without a sound. Sarah, he called out. There was no answer. Sarah! The silence was ominous, and he had this awful feeling in the pit of his stomach. He took a step into the apartment, and there she was, on the floor, on her back, wearing boxer shorts and an extra-large T-shirt, probably the clothes she slept in. Her eyes were wide open, staring up at the ceiling. She wasn't moving. He noticed her long legs were white as milk, as the girl never took time to just sit in the sun. DeMarco took two more steps, and he could see that her T-shirt, which was a burgundy color, was soaked with another color that was almost burgundy. He knew it was a waste of time, but he went down on one knee and felt for a pulse in her throat. There was no pulse. Sarah Johnson was dead. DeMarco walked outside and dropped down onto the porch steps. He felt completely numb. He sat there for a minute, unable to think, his mind like a whiteout in a blizzard, then reached for his phone and called 911. 5 minutes later, a squad car arrived, lights flashing, no siren. Two cops, one male, one female, both young, walked up the sidewalk toward him, hands on their holstered sidearms. Are you the one who called 911? The female cop asked. Yeah, DeMarco said. Sir, we need you to stand up and keep your hands where we can see them. Heckler called again while Marjorie was on the phone with one of Curtis's lawyers, and she let the call go to voicemail. She checked the voicemail 5 minutes later and heard Heckler say, You need to call me. The cops just arrived at Johnson's house. She called Heckler and said, What's happening? And why are you at Johnson's house? You're supposed to be following DeMarco. I was following him. He went to Johnson's place, and then he went inside, and 5 minutes later a squad car shows up. Now there's two more squad cars here and a couple of guys I think are detectives. Shit. The medical examiner just pulled up. Hang on a second, Marjorie said. I gotta think. She knew what had happened. Murdoch had killed Johnson, and DeMarco had discovered the body. Should she tell Heckler to split or not? The last thing she needed was a cop spotting Heckler hanging around the crime scene. On the other hand, she wanted to know what DeMarco was going to do next. You stick with DeMarco, she told Heckler. Then she lied. I don't know what the cops are doing at Johnson's house, but you make sure they don't see you. I don't want them questioning you, but stick with DeMarco and keep me posted.
2 hours after discovering Sarah's body, DeMarco left the police station. He told a detective how he knew Sarah and why he'd come to her house that morning. He told him about Sarah's crusade against Leonard Curtis and how she thought Curtis was bribing judges and politicians. He said the police should read Sarah's blog, that everything she'd learned or suspected had been dumped into it. He also said that Sarah had contacted various law enforcement agencies regarding Curtis, and the people she'd contacted were listed in her blog. The detective, a heavy-set guy with kind eyes, told DeMarco that he'd investigate those things, but it looked to him like Sarah had woken up and interrupted a burglary in progress, and that's why she was killed. All the small electronics were missing from Miss Johnson's apartment. We couldn't find a laptop or cell phone. All the drawers in her bedroom had been opened and pawed through. If she had any expensive jewelry, it's gone, and there was no cash in her purse. The detective paused and added, almost apologetically, like lots of places around the country, we have a meth problem here in Bismarck. And thanks to all the gas and oil workers, there's a lot of cash floating around, which tends to attract a bunch of bad actors. I don't think this was a robbery, DeMarco said. You think this guy Curtis had her killed? I don't know, but the timing bothers me, and it should bother you, too. She'd received 2 death threats and was assaulted once because she was writing about Curtis, and she just spent 3 days running around Montana and the Dakotas trying to find evidence she could use against him. DeMarco realized, as he was speaking, that he sounded like Sarah. No hard evidence, just conjecture based on coincidence. Did the person who lives next door to her hear the gunshots? DeMarco asked. No, she didn't hear the door being ripped open either, but the next-door neighbor is 76 years old. She doesn't wear a hearing aid, but she needs one. Or it could mean the killer used a silencer, DeMarco said. The detective made an expression that DeMarco interpreted as, not likely, and please leave the detecting to us. The detective asked DeMarco if he knew who Sarah's next of kin was, and DeMarco said, yeah, a man named Doug Thorpe, who lives near Miles City, Montana. He's her grandfather. I have his address and phone number. Do you want me to notify him about Sarah's death? No. You're a suspect, and... When DeMarco opened his mouth to protest, the detective said, I mean technically, since you found the body and admitted to spending the last several days with her, but do I really think you killed her? No, I don't. I'm just saying it wouldn't be appropriate for you to notify her next of kin. I'll call the right sheriff in Montana and have him go talk to Mr. Thorpe. DeMarco was relieved that he didn't have to break the news to Thorpe, and felt like a coward because he was relieved. He could imagine what Thorpe's reaction was going to be. He remembered how Thorpe had said that Sarah was the only family he had left, and how he loved her to death. He could also imagine that Thorpe might blame him for what happened to his granddaughter, and Thorpe might be right to blame him. It was possible that someone had found out that a guy from D.C. who might have some political clout was working with Sarah, and that may have been the catalyst for her being killed. He also wondered if he'd gone to see her last night, as she'd asked, if he could have prevented her death. He remembered telling Sarah how life was short and how she ought to spend some time enjoying it. He'd just never imagined how short her life would turn out to be. He could see her the first night he met her, her unlined face, her eyes blazing as she spoke about her obsession with Curtis. He remembered the way she laughed at the YouTube video. She'd been so terribly young and naive and earnest and good. DeMarco had heard the word heartsick before, but had never been sure what the word really meant. Now he knew. He was heartsick. Chapter 13. DeMarco called Mavis. He didn't even bother to try calling Mahoney directly, and told Mahoney's secretary to tell Mahoney to call him right away. Tell him Sarah Johnson was murdered. 10 minutes later, Mahoney called him back. What the fuck happened? Mahoney screamed. Then, being Mahoney, he had to add, What the fuck did you do?
DeMarco didn't answer Mahoney's question. He just told him that whoever killed Sarah had tried to make the crime look like a robbery, but he doubted it was. "But I don't know for sure that Curtis was responsible," DeMarco said. He also didn't tell Mahoney that Sarah had discovered something last night and wanted to talk to him about it, but that he'd been too preoccupied with getting laid to go see her. DeMarco didn't believe, maybe because he didn't want to believe, that whatever Sarah had uncovered had anything to do with her death. In 2 years of investigating, she'd never found any hard evidence, so why would last night have been any different? And how would anyone have known what she'd found last night? But since the killer had taken her laptop and her cell phone, and the police had locked up her house because it was a crime scene, DeMarco doubted there was any way to find out what she'd been working on the night she died. So he didn't believe, and again maybe because he didn't want to believe, that Sarah had found something last night that was the cause of her death. What he suspected was that Curtis had simply taken the next logical step. Since Sarah couldn't be bought off, discouraged by lawsuits or scared away by death threats and assaults, he decided to have her killed. "So what are you going to do?" Mahoney asked. "First, I'm going to go see Doug Thorpe and tell him how sorry I am." "Ah, oh, God, Doug," Mahoney said. "Does he know his granddaughter's dead?" "By now he probably does. The cops wouldn't let me tell him. They said they'd have the sheriffs where he lived notify him. I could call him and talk to him on the phone, but that doesn't seem right. I need to talk to him face to face, to explain what happened and to tell him how badly I feel. So I'm going to drive to Montana to see him." "Yeah, okay. Call me after you've talked to him, and I'll call him too." Mahoney sighed. "I imagine that will be the last time in my life I talk to him. Jesus. He calls me to help his granddaughter, and the next thing you know, she's dead. And he'll probably think it was your fault, which means he'll think it was my fault." DeMarco couldn't think of anything to say to that, so he didn't say anything. The worst part was that he knew it could indeed be his fault that she was killed. "What are you going to do after you see Doug?" Mahoney asked. DeMarco had been thinking about that question since the moment he saw Sarah's body. His first reaction to her death had been shock, followed by an overwhelming sense of sadness and a good deal of guilt. But now the main thing he was feeling was anger. "I don't know," he said to Mahoney. "But I do know that I'm not leaving this place until somebody pays for killing her. And I can tell you right now that the local cops aren't going to be much help. So one thing you can do is lean on somebody at the Bureau and get an FBI agent to meet with me." It occurred to DeMarco, after he talked to Mahoney, that it could be a mistake to drive 5 hours to Miles City to talk to Doug Thorpe, only to discover that Thorpe wasn't home and on his way to Bismarck to talk to the cops and to make arrangements for shipping Sarah's body back to Montana. He went back to the police station and asked the detective if anybody had talked to Thorpe yet. The detective was nice enough to call somebody, and a moment later told DeMarco that yes, Thorpe had been notified. DeMarco hated to do this over the phone, but he called Thorpe.
"Mr. Thorpe, it's Joe DeMarco. I'm sorry." "What the hell did you do?" Thorpe said.
He didn't scream like Mahoney had. He spoke quietly, but DeMarco could hear the cold fury in the man's voice. He also remembered the way Thorpe had sounded when he'd said that he would kill the people who had mauled Sarah and threatened her. His voice was the same when he asked what DeMarco had done.
"Mr. Thorpe," DeMarco said, "I don't know if I did anything that got her killed, but the truth is, I don't know for sure. The cops here think she was killed by a drug addict who broke into her house to rob her. I don't believe that. But, look, the reason I called is that if you're coming here for her body, I'm going to wait for you, and we'll talk when you get here. If you're not coming, of course I'm coming. I have to bring her home, then make funeral arrangements. I'll bury her next to my wife and daughter."
Then Thorpe started sobbing and hung up on DeMarco. And DeMarco had a vivid image of Doug Thorpe standing in front of 3 headstones in a small Montana cemetery. Heartsick. DeMarco returned to the Holiday Inn and got his room back. He unpacked his clothes and threw them into a couple of plastic bags he found in the closet and headed out to find a laundromat. He had no idea how long he was going to be in Bismarck. While his clothes were washing, he went to a nearby coffee shop and tried to figure out what to do next. Only one idea occurred to him. Using his phone, He found out that he couldn't get a direct flight from Bismarck to Great Falls, Montana. The best flight he could find stopped in Denver and would take 5 hours. And he sure as hell wasn't going to drive from Bismarck to Great Falls, which would take 9 hours. When it came to air travel, this part of the country was like Siberia. He called the Bismarck airport and, after getting bounced around a bit, found himself talking to a woman who had a voice deeper than his. He told her what he wanted, a pilot to fly him to Great Falls tomorrow morning. He returned to the laundromat and tossed his clothes into a dryer. He was feeding quarters into the dryer when his phone rang. It was Mahoney. "The FBI has a satellite office in Bismarck," Mahoney said, "but there are only a few guys there, and they're all busy. The main field office for North Dakota is in Minneapolis, but—" "God damn it," DeMarco said. "I have to go to fucking Minneapolis to talk to an FBI agent?" "Shut up. An agent named Westerberg will be in Bismarck this evening. He'll call you when he gets there. He's got your number." "Thanks," DeMarco said, but Mahoney had already hung up. Mahoney must have pounded on someone over at the Hoover Building, and Mahoney was a hammer too big to ignore. At the same time, DeMarco couldn't help but think, too little, too late. This is what he should have done in the first place, gotten the FBI involved before somebody killed Sarah Johnson. DeMarco returned to his motel with his freshly laundered clothes. There wasn't anything for him to do until he talked to Doug Thorpe in the FBI. He pulled out his laptop and looked at Sarah's blog, hoping that she'd updated it since he spoke to her the night before. She hadn't. The last entry she'd made was when they were traveling from Rapid City back to Bismarck, and then she just rambled on about the depressing state of American politics. DeMarco had fallen asleep reading Sarah's blog and was awakened by his ringing phone. "This is Doug Thorpe," the caller said. "Where are you?" "I'm at my motel," DeMarco said. "I was just waiting for you to call. Tell me where you are and I'll meet you." "I'm down at the morgue," Thorpe said. "Oh," DeMarco said. "I need a drink. I gotta get the smell of this place out of my nose. I'll meet you at—" DeMarco was on his way to meet Thorpe at a restaurant near the Bismarck morgue when his phone rang again. The caller ID showed a 763 area code. "Hello," he said. "This is Special Agent Westerberg." Westerberg turned out to be a she and not a he, as Mahoney had said. "I've been ordered to meet with you." She said this like she wasn't happy that some politician had squeezed her boss's nuts. "I'll be in Bismarck by 7 this evening. I'm staying at the Radisson. I've stayed there before, and there's a place called the Pierogue Grill on 4th Street. Meet me there at 8. Westerberg said this like she was issuing an order, not making a request. "Okay," DeMarco said. "How will I recognize you?" "I'll probably be the only woman in the bar packing a gun in a shoulder holster." With that, she hung up. DeMarco saw Thorpe sitting at a table by himself, staring out the window. The sky was overcast, and it looked as if a lightning storm might start any moment. Thorpe's face looked like the sky, like a storm cloud. DeMarco sat down across from him. Thorpe was drinking whiskey out of a shot glass, taking small sips. Before DeMarco had a chance to say how bad he felt about Sarah's death, Thorpe said, "So what happened?" DeMarco told him what he and Sarah had been doing before she died, how they had attempted to talk to 4 people, trying to find whoever Curtis was using to make payoffs to judges and politicians. DeMarco admitted that it had been his idea. "I thought that if we could identify Curtis's fixer, we might be able to force him to testify against Curtis," DeMarco said. "But I don't know if that's why she was killed." DeMarco watched as the blood rushed to Thorpe's face, turning his normally tanned complexion an angry shade of purple. "Are you telling me you think some robber—" "No, Mr. Thorpe, I don't think she was killed by a robber. I'm saying that while I was with Sarah, she didn't find anything new. Nobody would talk to her. She didn't get any new evidence against Curtis or anybody else. The other thing is, as far as I know, nobody knew I was working with her, or that she was talking to these people. So maybe Curtis ordered her death, but if he did, it was something he set in motion before I got here. Or maybe as soon as I got here. But the other thing is, Curtis would have to be crazy to have her killed. Sarah never found a thing in the 2 years she was going after him that could cause him a significant legal problem.
So if Curtis didn't have her killed, who did? I don't know. Sarah accused a lot of people in her blog about being in collusion with Curtis. Maybe one of them killed her. Or maybe Curtis's fixer somehow found out that we were looking for him. I don't know. But the main thing I wanted to tell you is that Mahoney talked to the FBI today, and I'm meeting with an agent this evening. Why didn't you and John get the FBI involved in the first place? Because we didn't have anything to get the FBI involved. Sarah had no evidence any crimes had been committed. But now, yeah, now you got a crime. Somebody killed her. I'm sorry, Doug. I'm sorry about everything. Thorpe finished the whiskey remaining in the shot glass. He winced when he swallowed, as if he wasn't used to the taste. As he rose from the table, he said, I'm going to take care of Curtis. DeMarco knew Thorpe wasn't talking about pursuing a legal case against Leonard Curtis. He was talking about killing the man. Leave Curtis alone, DeMarco said. You do something to him, you're just going to end up in jail. With Sarah and my daughter both gone, DeMarco, I don't care about jail. Doug, I don't know for sure that Curtis had anything to do with your granddaughter's death, so I'm asking you to give me a chance to find out who killed her before you do anything. Please? I know I screwed this up, but give me a chance. And let me get the FBI engaged before you do something you'll regret. I'm also flying to Great Falls tomorrow morning. Why? DeMarco told him why he was going to Great Falls, but Thorpe didn't seem impressed. At this point, Thorpe had no confidence in DeMarco, and DeMarco couldn't blame him. Just give me a few days, DeMarco said, okay? You take care of Sarah. Let me know when the funeral is, and I'll keep you informed of what I'm doing. Well, you better do something, son, because if you don't, I will. DeMarco watched Thorpe walk away. The first time he met Thorpe at his cabin near the Yellowstone River, DeMarco had been struck by how he looked. Over 70 years old, but strong, fit, and vigorous. Now he just looked like an old man that time had run over. He was a person who'd served his country in an extraordinary way, and, unlike John Mahoney and Joe DeMarco, had probably lived a blameless life. But here he was, in the waning days of his existence, stripped of everyone he'd ever loved, wife, daughter, and granddaughter. If there was a God, DeMarco had to wonder about his grand plan. Chapter 14. There were five women in the bar of the Pirogue Grill. Three of the women were with men. The fourth was a young lady with a blue streak in her hair, a ring through her left nostril, jabbering in a high-pitched voice on a cell phone. DeMarco doubted that blue hair and nose rings were allowed by the Bureau's dress code. The last woman was sitting alone at a table with her back to the wall. The woman looked like she was about 40 and had dark red hair, the color of mahogany. She was wearing a navy blue suit with a skirt. She had good legs, a white blouse, and a blue and white scarf tied to resemble a man's tie. Her face was narrow with high cheekbones and a wide, sensual mouth. She was attractive, but DeMarco's first impression was, tough cookie. She appeared to be drinking a martini, and DeMarco decided to have one, too. He waved at her to let her know that he'd seen her, then walked up to the bar and ordered a drink. After it arrived, he walked over to the table. Agent Westerberg, I presume. Yeah, she said. Instead of pulling out her ID, she pulled back her suit jacket and showed him the Glock in the shoulder holster. I'm Joe DeMarco. Thanks for meeting with me. I wasn't given a choice. And all I was told was that a young woman named Sarah Johnson was murdered last night and the former Speaker of the House isn't happy that no one solved the crime yet. So what's going on? DeMarco told her about Sarah's blog and how she'd been on a crusade the last 2 years to nail a rich gas guy named Leonard Curtis who was buying off lawmakers and judges to get his way. But she never found any hard evidence that Curtis had done anything illegal because he makes these tricky, under-the-table deals with politicians that you would never be able to prove are bribes. Let me tell you about the seed drill. Seed drill? What the hell's a seed drill? He told her what a seed drill was, and how one state legislator miraculously changed his vote after he got a bargain on one. You gotta be shitting me, Westerberg said. No,